With the recent alarming rise of anti-Semitism in wake of the atrocities perpetrated on October 7th by Hamas, it's well worthwhile to dig deeper into what exactly is anti-Semitism, the roots. Why do we find throughout history that Jews were always singled out more than any other minority in hatred, discrimination, expulsion, genocide? Now, from a scientific point of view, it's very difficult to associate anti-Semitism with one particular cause when it goes back millennia. For example, to say it's a result of Christian discrimination, well, there was anti-Semitism before Christianity, or Islam anti-Semitism against Jews. So we have to find something, some common denominator that would transcend all the different millennia, all the different centuries, the different empires, the different situations. What lies at the root? Once you get to the root, it can help us, perhaps, to finally uproot this cancer, what we can do about it. So please join me in this critical conversation, the evil of anti-Semitism. Hi, Simon Jacobson here, and we will be speaking about something extremely relevant today, the evil of anti-Semitism. Ironically, since the atrocities perpetrated by Hamas on October 7th, there's been an alarming rise in anti-Semitism all around the world. You would think it would be the other way around. Yes, there's also been a rise of beautiful solidarity, people coming out on behalf of Israel, on behalf of the Jewish people. But we also see the other side. So it behooves us to dig deeper, to try to understand. You know, as rational people, civil people, we hope, what lies at the heart of this irrational hatred? And not just hatred, a hatred that has been translated into the most inhumane, savage, brutal atrocities, whether in the form of expulsions, this type of discrimination, form of genocides. You know, you go through history, talk about the Egyptian enslaving the Jewish people, biblical times. And you talk about the hatred when the Jews come through the wilderness, the different nations they encounter who saw them as an enemy. The country, the nation called Amalek. Fast forward a bit, you go to the Babylonian Empire, the Assyrian Empire, the Babylonian Empire, the Greeks, the Persians, time of Persian Empire, where Haman and Persia wanted to turn total genocide of all men, women, and children, Jewish men, women, and children, the story of Purim. Then you have the Roman Empire destroying the second temple, as the Babylonians did the first one. You go through the Ottoman Empire, the Spanish Empire, the expulsion of the Jews in 1492. Prior to that, you have the Crusades. You have the Inquisitions, you have the pogroms, and finally, the Holocaust. And I just listed a partial list. So when you have it on so many different situations, so many different places on earth, under different types of empires, under religions, under non-religions, because with Hitler, the Nazis, there was Stalin, Joseph Stalin, in the former Soviet Union. So from a scientific point of view, you can't say it's associated with a particular set of conditions. You know, many, for instance, attribute anti-Semitism, which, by the way, was coined in the 19th century. So we're not talking about the word, we're talking about the experience, to Christianity's persecution of the Jews as Christ killers. But that would explain things only from the time that Christianity came on the scene. How about prior to that? So how do you explain this? What is something in common where the Jews seem to be the single most discriminated against minority? And many theories have been posited from the fact that that Jews have always been a successful minority, which means an easy scapegoat, to the fact the conspiracy theories of the protocols of the elders of Zion, that the Jews are conspiring to control the world, and that they do indeed control the world, the media, the banks, governments. But what lies behind those conspiracies? What lies behind all of that? The stereotype of the Shylock, the Jew is a money lender. With all the caricatures and all the stereotypes around that, you still don't get to the root of it. What lies at the heart of it? And what really is so disturbing is it's so irrational. You would think in a scientific world, in a world of the Enlightenment, yeah, but Voltaire was a rabid anti-Semite, as was Martin Luther, as was some other so-called thinkers. Yes, there were quite a few that also loved Jews, respected them. Could say maybe more respected than loved. So what is this about the Jew that is the lightning rod, or what some call the miner's canary, that whenever there's problems, it is the Jew that is always identified, always targeted? And here again today, in our times, when you would think again, after everything we've gone through, we have a little land called Israel. Let us live in peace. What do you want? No, not just killing and murder, but in a most brutal fashion, without going into all the graphic details. I believe when we do get to the core of it, not only will it teach us what drives this hatred, this evil, but it'll teach us something about ourselves, about all human beings. And once you learn about that, it could also teach us how we can remedy it. Because just as anti-Semitism is so universal throughout history, its cure, its antidote is also universal. In other words, if it's something that has affected so many societies and so many different periods and eras in time, then the converse is also true, that whatever it is that drives it, that can be repaired, it's also a universal repair. And indeed, that's exactly what we pray and hope for. The end of days, what we call the Messianic Age, a world of peace and harmony. And when the Jews will be left at peace, the world will have peace. As we shall discuss, that the blessings are not just Jewish blessings, but they're universal ones. So, here we go. To really appreciate this, I think we need to go back to the beginning. What does the beginning mean? The beginning of documented human history. And in biblical terms, the story of Adam and Eve, the Garden of Eden. We're told God creates a universe, and yes, he plants a tree called the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Basically, two paths, the path of life, of good, of light, and the path of death, darkness, evil. And you need to choose. The human being was sent to this world to be a divine ambassador, to bring light into a dark world, a world that can be hostile, that can be selfish, a world where people are driven by self-interest, in the Freudian id, the social Darwinian survival of the fittest, that in a world like that, enter this world and transform it into a divine garden, a Garden of Eden. However, because we have free will, we can choose the other path. So in a way, you can say, as explained in the classic work, the Tanya, there are two voices inside each of us. The selfish voice, the voice of survival, of existence, taking care of myself, my needs, the selfish gene, using Dawkins' term. And then there's the voice of transcendence. I'm here to serve, to give, to bring something greater, to bring light to the world. And there's a battle going on, a perpetual battle. And it's up to you and I to choose. To choose, of course, the path of life, the path of light, the path of good. But there's a battle. That battle is inherent into the very fiber of existence. To use somewhat Kabbalistic terminology, this battle is the mere fact, in the words of the Holy Arizal, of Isaac Luria, the mystic, the 16th century mystic who expounded the doctrine of tzimtzum, of concealment, that in order for existence to be an independent consciousness, the divine consciousness, which was all-encompassing, omnipresent, concealed itself to allow space for another. Think of a brilliant teacher. As long as his brilliance fills the expanse of everyone's consciousness, there's no room for independence of a student, of a child, of another. So to leave room for another is a tzimtzum. The tzimtzum's purpose is that we exist so we could be able to choose. But let's call it this way. Let's put it this way. A tzimtzum that's distorted, where the concealment becomes an end in itself, and you buy into it, instead of seeing it as a springboard for a deeper revelation, for a deeper consciousness, it becomes the root of the division between people, can ultimately lead to their divisiveness. Their diversity leads to divisiveness, which leads to hostility, which can ultimately lead to all conflicts, all the way to war and every form of discrimination. To put it in other terms, maybe we'll use a little language of modern physics, that there's an integral unity in all of existence. Everything's connected. The fact that the naked eye and our empirical tools don't experience it is simply because we're blinded. But everything is connected. Think of a human body. There's not one cell among the trillions of cells, the 35 to 45, the 75 trillion cells within us, all interconnected. And a healthy person, all coordinated. So if one thing is not working well, it affects everything else. So then, of course, the question is, if we're all connected, how is it possible one human being can hate another? How is it possible that one person can turn another and ultimately lead to the injustices, even to the very savagery that we've witnessed in history? That's because we're blinded. We don't see it. That symptom conceals that connection. But if we really knew it was there, would it be possible that the right arm would turn on the left arm? That one part of the body would turn on another? Yes, we have diseases like that, where the body turns on itself. God forbid. One of the most horrible types of disease. So it's all due to a concealment. This explains the heart and root of where hatred, and ultimately everything that hatred brings, including violence. How is that possible? Because of that concealment. Now, when you continue the story, you see the world actually did not choose well, to the point that the world became so corrupt that God brought a great flood to cleanse and re-begin, reset, reboot. Noah and his family begin rebuilding civilization. 10 generations later, the birth of Abraham. This is a watershed moment. Abraham introduces back to the world, no, there's a higher purpose. It's not just a pagan, selfish reality, dog eats dog, of power and control, but there's higher purpose. And we are sent to this world not just to take care of ourselves, but to be virtuous, to be giving, to be loving. Chesed, kindness, is the essence of what life is all about. And he teaches it to his children. And they teach it to their children. And here is the birth, what we call the first Jew. But technically, he wasn't yet what we call legally a Jew, but he was a Jew in concept. So what Judaism really is, and what a Jew really is the representation of a voice, of a conscience, of a force, individually in each one of us, microcosm and a macrocosmic level, a voice in the world that dictates that we're not just here to take care of ourselves, we're here to serve a higher purpose, a transcendent purpose. So you could imagine that the material world and all that it represents, including its leaders, very threatened by Abraham, because he's suddenly taking away the center of gravity from the monarch, Nimrod, or whoever is the leader, and instead saying, no, all of us are human beings, and there's one answer to one higher creator that's not human. Very threatening. And indeed, Abraham was the ultimate nonconformist, the pioneer, that we don't worship humans, we don't worship materialism, and we don't worship anything that's man-made. We connect to something greater than ourselves. And that's the foundation of all morality. The founding fathers, and I'm going fast forward, but I'll get back to Abraham in a moment. The founding fathers appreciated that and understood that's the essence of any humane and decent society. All men are created equal. All people are created equal. And the Creator has endowed every human being with inalienable rights, the rights of freedom, the freedom of religion, the freedom of speech, the freedom of expression. And no one can take that from you because no one gave it to you. It comes from a higher force. As soon as one human being grants it to you, they can always take it away from you. That's what Abraham taught. So you could imagine the entire world was not very happy with that. That is the heart of essentially what anti-Semitism really is. I don't even want to use the word anti-Semitism in this context because it takes on a certain, I don't know, it's psychological or political meaning, far, far deeper. It's a cosmic hostility from a material world that wants to take care of itself, the hostility it has and the resentment it has to a conscience and a transcendent voice that wants something greater than just me, me, me. So it's essentially the battle between self-interest and transcendent interest. The greater good or my good? Will you live an egocentric life or a mission-centric or divine-centric life? And that's what Abraham represented. And it's interesting, Abraham is called the father of all nations because indeed he would have children. His children would be Ishmael, the ancestor of the what would later be the Arab-Muslim world, and a son called Isaac, the ancestor of the Jewish people. Isaac, in turn, would have two children, as we read in this biblical chapter this week, Esav and Jacob. Esav the warrior would be the ancestor of the Western Roman Christian world, and Jacob, son of Isaac, of the Jewish world. And their confrontations throughout history all are rooted back in the home of Abraham and then in the home of Isaac. So what do we read? We read, in this chapter we read, that Rebekah, the wife of Isaac, was pregnant. It was a very difficult pregnancy. She was in great pain. She turns to God, why is my pregnancy so difficult? And the response, the divine response, because you carry two nations within you, two nations that will be at each other's throats throughout history. When one rises, the other one will fall. And when the other one rises, the first one will fall. Esav and Jacob, twins, alter egos, parallel universes. One is the warrior, the hunter, knows how to survive, and is a master of that. And the other is the wholesome scholar, the spiritual one. Essentially, the soul and the body. The spiritual needs of a person and the material needs. Now, it's important to emphasize, materialism on its own is not bad. It's the world that God created. It becomes a problem when it's materialism as an end in itself and not being harnessed and directed towards spiritual ends. As I said earlier, the concealment is a divine concealment. The problems begin when you take the concealment as an end in itself and don't realize that it's there to introduce the divine. And hence this battle between them. Later we will read, as the narrative unfolds, that even when they reconcile, there's something inherent tension between the two. This, my friends, is the heart of it all. And even if you were to speak to anti-Semites, they may not even be able to identify it. They'll find all kinds of reasons, that the Jews are powerful, that the Jews are manipulative, all kinds of reasons. The heart of it is, either consciously or subconsciously, because there's a difficulty for nations of the world that are still being driven by self-interest to accept a people that have embraced the path of God. The story is not over. So don't think this is a form of discrimination against the nations of the world. That's not where I'm leading to. But that's the initial step, and that's what Abraham was facing. People who saw him as an enemy. Let's talk about it in a more practical terms. What Abraham taught his children, and his children taught their children, was a threat to other societies, because anyone who's in control, any majority, anyone in power, wants people to conform to them. They don't tolerate something different. And the Jewish people, starting from Abraham, began to introduce something different. What is different? Actually, if it was appreciated, and it should be appreciated, and it will be appreciated, and it was appreciated by many, we would value it. But when you don't understand it, this different thing is threatening. Pharaoh says to his people, these people here, who brought us many blessings, remember Joseph turned Egypt into an empire, because the commodity of the world was then grain. And due to the great famine and Joseph's ingenuity and planning, Egypt had hoarded and gathered together so much grain that helped save the world. But it definitely brought Egypt to greatness. And yet Pharaoh is threatened. Something about them is different. And if we don't do anything about it, they will ultimately control us. Basically, a man of control wants control and is always afraid of others controlling him. Little did he know that was not the case. The Jewish people just brought him prosperity, it would have brought him more prosperity. So let's enslave them. Let's figure out, let's conspire, is what Pharaoh says, to enslave them, to control them. And this is the story that continues in every generation, another form of it. Let's go turn fast forward to the story of Purim. What does Haman tell Ahasuerus? We read in the Megillah, we read in the book of Esther. He says, you are the emperor, you are the superpower. King Ahasuerus controlled the entire world, 127 nations in his Persian Empire, from India all the way to Ethiopia, basically Asia through all the way to Africa, which was the major bulk or all the bulk of the population at the time. And what does Haman say to him? There's this one nation, he's talking about the Jews, that are mefurzim mefurzim, they're spread all over your empire. And their traditions, their faith is different than all of ours. Something about them is different. And what provoked him was when Mordechai, his alter ego, sends Haman and Mordechai, like Esav and Jacob, when everybody was bowing to him because Ahasuerus said that Haman should be respected, only one man refused to bow, Mordechai. He refused to bow to Haman. Refused to bow, which incited and infuriated Haman. What was Mordechai saying? I don't bow to human beings. I only have one God. I don't bow to human beings. I don't bow to human institutions. The famous story with the previous Chabad Rebbe when he was arrested by the Bolsheviks. They wanted to intimidate him. So someone pointed a gun to his head. It was actually a Jewish anti-Semite. I said in Yiddish to the Rebbe, this pistol here has made many people cooperate. And the Rebbe looked at him with calm, without missing a beat, and said to him, this toy, this tzatzke, can only frighten someone that has one world and many gods, but not someone that has one god and many worlds. Mordechai refused to bow. And that's what incensed Haman. Why? Because people have control. I want control. Here's a person. So it's really a deep insecurity, perhaps, on his part. Because if you're so confident, why do you need him to bow to you? So he doesn't. But we're not going now into a psychoanalysis. Well, partially, yes. But it could be other reasons as well. Bottom line is, someone who is in control of the material world is threatened by someone who does not conform to that. Someone who is not going to worship money and power and control. You can't buy him. And this has been the story. This by no means is suggesting that every Jewish person is a perfect and doesn't have their own issues. But the archetype of the Jew and the model of that, the living model, the shining example of that, the quintessential Jew, Abraham, Mordechai, called Yehudi. One of the names for a Jew is Yehudi. Yehudi comes from the word acknowledging, commitment. To whom? To God. And denying and rejecting anything but God. Everything else is idolatry. That is a threat. That's a threat to the seat of power. It's a threat to the things that we value when we're a material, living in a material world. So think of this bizarre distortion. The Jew, the quintessential Jew, the archetype of the Jew, was meant to introduce into the world a fresh perspective of transcendence, but the world sees it as threatening, especially initially. But here is where the story continues to develop. We come to Sinai, and here the Jewish people formally receive the mandate, I am your God. Do not have false gods. Do not worship anything men do. We are all created in the divine image. Every human being on this earth, live up to that divine image through virtue, through kindness, through nobility. So instead of being appreciated, of course, this material world not only is resistant, despises this, despises the conscience, despises this standard, this higher standard. Kill the witness. Essentially, kill the witness that witnessed God's presence in this world. The truth is, it's meant to elevate the entire world. So that was then. But as time passed, and to paraphrase the Maimonides, that with the birth of Christianity and then later with Islam, one way or another, the children of Esav, respectively, and the children of Yishmael, do start coming around from a pagan Roman world. It starts becoming a world of faith. Christianity introduces the principles of Sinai. I'm not getting into now the details and any of the distortions or flaws, but the general principle. And the same thing in the pagan Arab world. Muhammad introduces, Islam introduces, certain principles of Abraham. Abraham's ideas that he taught in his home begin to seep into society. But still, the Jew remains the enemy. Essentially, because the divine is seen as an enemy by the material world. But then centuries pass, and look what happens. Around 250 years ago, a nation is born called the United States of America. And no one planned it. Initially, it was under the control of Great Britain, until finally, the founding fathers and the original colonies said, enough is enough. We don't want to be overtaxed. We don't want to be oppressed by you. We want our freedom of religion. We want our freedom. And they build a new nation. They declare their independence. Choosing what? The principles of Sinai, the principles of the Bible. They're beginning to integrate. Instead of seeing it as a threat, they see it as really the source of their inspiration. Check out On Two Wings by Michael Novak, The Hebrew Republic, another book, how the roots of this republic, the United States, and its freedoms are all built on Torah metaphysics. They begin to appreciate. But there's plenty of built-in intrinsic anti-Semitism, using again that word, the anti-God element. And especially when you start introducing the Enlightenment that was really trying to say we can have science and free inquiry without a God. Look where that led. Look what's happening in the universities now without a God. Complete blurring of what is right and wrong. They all need the Jew. When I say the Jew, I don't mean the individual, I mean the archetype, which is represented by you and I. So now, when all of this explodes yet again, it's just telling us there's work to be done. So of course, what needs to be done on the short term, immediate term, is to eradicate any evil that threatens any innocent man, woman, and child, especially those in the Holy Land. But Israel and the Jewish people represent the conscience. They represent the highest standards of transcendence. There's a fascinating medrash that says that if the nations of the world knew the blessings that came to them from Israel, from the Jewish people, from the Holy Temple, from Jerusalem, instead of attacking it, they would surround it with legions to protect it. Like we read about Abraham, those that bless you shall be blessed. Many understand that today, but many still don't. So our job, my friends, is to rise to the occasion. Yes, to fight the fights, and do we have to do is to eliminate any of the enemies, immediate enemies. But the real victory is one much greater, is going back to reintroduce Abraham to the world, to reintroduce that Judaism is not just for Jews. Yes, there are mitzvahs and commandments and particular traditions and mitzvahs that are for Jews, but the universal principles that God gave to mankind, that mankind, that you were all created in the divine image, the Jew as a light unto nations, the temple as a house of prayer for all peoples, that's the ultimate victory, and that's what we need to rise to the occasion. So what's happening now, yes, we need to deal. This is definitely a war that needs to be fought to eliminate that type of evil and barbarism and savagery, but ultimately to educate those that are open to be educated. And we have to see the world as being open to it. And our job is, and I've never been prouder to be a Jew than now, our job is exactly that, to be that living model. One of the messages I gave last week was a call to my Muslim cousins and friends. What would Abraham say? That's what we have to ask ourselves. What would Abraham say to you right now? What does Abraham teach? The values of kindness, generosity, of law, of justice, virtue, transcendence. So there lies within existence an inherent resistance and hostility, and even worse than that. But that's what we need to overcome and realize, know that your blessing is there. Esav comes to realize that Jacob is actually a source of his blessings, because Jacob harnesses the blessings and helps the nations of the world access and discover their destiny and their calling. And that's why indeed when it says at the end of days, after these battles will be finished, and hopefully very quickly, because remember, it accumulates, the goodness of this transcendent voice has been accumulating. Evil does not accumulate. So we're right at the threshold. And what will be the end story? The end story is a story of redemption, a story that all nations of the world will be transformed and speak the language of God. In their diversity, we will find harmony. That the business of the world will be what, as Maimonides says? Not materialism as an end in itself, but to know God, transcendence. A world filled with divine knowledge as the waters cover the sea, and that's where there will be no more evil and no more destruction. You see the correlation? Because when we embrace that transcendent voice, it's not your enemy. It's actually your friend. This is what we have to tell the material world. This is what the nations of the world who still have that hostility, they have to realize, this is your blessing. This is your purpose. You just don't know it yet. So understanding the root and the heart of where this hatred comes from is also its undoing, by understanding that the real purpose of this material world and even your power and control is not about you. It's to serve something greater. And then you can harness your strengths and your powers. And that is also the secret to Jewish survival, why we're here and all those nations are not here. Because those nations, they rose by the sword and they died by the sword. They rose by their egos and died by the egos. The Jewish people, ultimately, it was the humility that we are serving something greater than ourselves. If you serve humans, humans are mortal, then your cause is also mortal and it will come to an end like everything that is mortal. But when you're connected to something immortal and eternal, then you and your people become eternal. And this is a choice for every person on this earth. And I would say this to a person who considers themselves someone that maybe no one wants to acknowledge they're anti-Semite, they have their justifications. But just in case you have that type of resentment to the Jewish people or to any Jew, sometimes masked in the disguise of anti-Israel, anti-Zionism. So perhaps think about it. Be open-minded enough to realize that what you hate is sometimes the thing you need most. And realize that you have to dig deeper and find the thing that will redeem you and help you transform even your negative energy. And most important, your ignorance, to realize where the true blessings lie. So the Jewish people, now is the time of history to rise and be that light unto nations, to rise and live up to our true destiny, because that's what the world needs to hear. They need to hear that transcendence, and that's what is now this time. So yes, we have plenty of grief, pain, darkness, suffering, but above all, what it does is brings out the best in us to really use this. It's a historic wake-up call. A historic wake-up call, like never before to show what a Jew is. Never before to show what a human being created in the divine image can do. In a deeper love for others, deeper unity, more kindness, more gentleness, more inspiration, more light. And even a little light, and definitely a lot of light, dispels darkness. To the point that we're told we transform darkness to light. This is, my friends, our time. Let us rise to that occasion. Let us rise to our calling. This is our destiny. And finish the story, the narrative, the way it was meant to be finished, as Abraham taught us over 3,800 years ago. That we'll finally experience a world of total, personal, and global redemption. May God bless all the innocent men, women, and children and protect them in the Holy Land and everywhere in the world. And God bless you and each of us. Do our part in fulfilling this calling. Thank you. This has been Simon Jacobson, MeaningfulLife.com. Please check us out. We have a special section devoted to the events of our time. MeaningfulLife.com/war in Israel. Many resources. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel. Please share. And I'd love to hear your feedback and thoughts. Be well and be blessed. Thank you.
This program is brought to you by the Meaningful Life Center. Please help us continue our programs. Make even a small contribution at MeaningfulLife.com/donate.